Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Nicolet Wealth Management Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Anthony Wilhelms, and with me are our chief investment officers, Mike Steppy and Adam Longley. There's always a lot going on in the world. Mike, can you give us an idea of what's been happening over the last month?
It's always happy to start with sort of good news. The S&P 500 index is up over 10% in 2024 year to date. The technology sector is leading that, up 13.6%. But even if you exclude technology from the S&P 500, it's up a solid 8.45%. Middle and small cap stocks have lagged, up less than 4%. International stocks, developed markets, up around 6%, and emerging markets up just under 3%. As Adam has mentioned in the last couple of podcasts, stocks hitting new highs have a history of continuing to push higher, and we're seeing that. So thank you, Adam. Economic data is continuing to support our themes for 2024. Solid economic data, but slowing. Inflation coming down, but more sticky than expected. Labor markets remain tight. And the Fed is pivoting towards an easing in policy. If you look at interest rates, we've seen these big movements. If you go back to the middle of October, five-year treasuries were just under 5%. By year end, they dropped down to 380, or a decrease of 116 basis points. Then by the middle of March, they were up to 434, an increase of 54 basis points. So it's felt like a roller coaster. And what's driving that roller coaster is perceptions of the Fed. It's likely that the Fed is going to cut rates this year. The first rate cut I'm expecting at the June 12th meeting, that'd be a cut of 25 basis points. And the market's looking at that and saying there's an 80% probability of that happening. The fixed income market this year has been whipsawed by expecting too many rate cuts. If you go back to the end of December, the market was expecting 6 rate cuts in 2024. We're now back to 3 rate cuts, maybe 4, but the perception has changed, and we've come back to more rational levels. The dollar has followed the path of interest rates over the past 6 months. So you go back to mid-October, dollar really strong. It weakened into December, down about 5%. Then as interest rates lifted, the dollar's up 2.6% in 2024. Interest rate differentials continue to favor. I know this is sort of, I say this at every one of these podcasts, but it's correct in that these interest rate differentials continue to favor money flowing into the U.S. So this morning, rates were at a 4.20 on a 10-year Treasury note, and a German Bund was at 2.32. So a differential of 1.88, or almost 2% differential for a foreign investor to move into a 10-year Treasury versus a German Bund. Commodity prices are also up. West Texas Intermediate trading over $80 a barrel, $81.30 this morning. The six-month range that we've seen has been about $70 a barrel to $84, so we're towards the higher end of that range. Copper up over $4 a pound. Six-month range there has been about $3.60 to $4.10. So when you look at that, again, we're towards the higher end of that range. Gold at $2,177 per ounce, six-month range there, $1,820 to $2,186. And gold is at an all-time high. So we just had a lot of things going on in the markets, and we're really off to a great start in 2024.
Woof, what a year. I like the kickoff, Mike. I'm going to come back to you with a question related to the Fed or the FOMC meetings. But you talk about Fed pivot, and we talk all the time, it seems like, that the direction of the Fed is obvious. And that was kind of said at the beginning of 2023, it proved not to be true, that the path wasn't as obvious as we might have thought at the beginning of the year. And we, I'm talking collectively as investment people, not just the three of us here. As we look at now, I think you said it was projected at 6 cuts in 2024 when we were talking at the beginning of December 23. Now it's down to 3. So my question is a little bit related to what do you see going forward, but more specifically, what are the reasons that we might see that rate cutting path derailed? What might cause rates to stay flat through the year or go up?
I think it comes down to what the Fed is thinking. The Fed can adjust these short-term rates to where they want them to be. And I think the Fed is concerned that the Fed recognizes that rates are above a neutral rate that you would expect long-term for overnight rates. They knew that. They pushed rates up to this to sort of dampen down inflation. They're seeing inflation come down, and I think they will lower interest rates because they see, look, having rates artificially high hurts manufacturing, it hurts real estate, it hurts banking. And if they leave them at these levels for a long enough period of time, they're going to have something's going to blow up. So I think the Fed feels they're walking sort of a tightrope. They're trying to be patient about this. They're trying, and they have been. They haven't changed policy for the last 5 meetings. And my guess is they won't change it at the May 1st meeting. So we'll go 6 meetings without the Fed making a change. But I think then they will, because I think they do believe that rates are too high right at the moment for what the economy can absorb. There are just deals that from a real estate perspective don't pencil out. From a manufacturing perspective, just doesn't work. The companies can't do these things that they want to do and that they feel they need to do, but it's because interest rates are too high.
I love it. Adam, to you. Mike talked about nice equity performance for the year and your comments about when things go up, they tend to keep going up. What do you see going forward and what's driving the S&P to those new levels?
Yeah, maybe just as a reminder here, so far this year in 2024, you've seen the S&P 500 close the day at an all-time high 17 times. And, you know, as we discussed before, this tends to persist. And these all-time highs, they tend to cluster. So if you go back and look at 1958 to 1968, we saw 281 all-time highs. And then from 1980 to 2000, we saw 513 all-time highs. If you go back further than 2024, start of the year, and look at since 2013 to today, we've had over 350 all-time highs. I think what's interesting is, had you on average bought the market at an all-time high, your average return 1 year later would be up 7.5%. And you would have made money 70% of the time. So again, that's why we view this as a positive. So, to the question, why? Why is the market so strong? I think it's you're seeing economic growth is not only positive, but it's even better than expected. So you've got these positive surprises, positive revisions, earnings from these publicly traded companies. Their earnings are positive growth, and they also have been better than expected. And then looking, into the future here, not only is the positive growth expected to continue, but consensus is that it's going to actually accelerate and get even better, which would imply, maybe a new beginning of a new cycle, and there's some legs to the rally. So I think it's as simple as the current environment is positive, and stocks are forward looking, and they're reflecting that.
I like that. That's a good message going forward. Now let's shift to sector specifics. Mike mentioned tech is up leading the way again this year. Obviously, we saw the end of 2023. Is there still more room for tech to run, or is there a world where this should be some type of rotation to some of the lagging sectors?
I think with technology, with the tech sector, I think people should be selective and think stock specific. They're in the tech sector, there's individual companies that are just fantastic businesses, some of the best ever. And by that, we mean they have really high return on invested capital. They have really low cost of capital. You know, a lot of them are in a net cash position. So, you know, they're just not affected. Or maybe they have a positive benefit from interest rates going up. And they generate a ton of free cash flow. And then they have opportunities to invest that free cash flow through the positive spread, right, between their high returns and their low costs. That essentially is value creation. And a lot of that goes to the shareholders, whether it's dividends or in tech, maybe more in share buybacks. So those businesses with those positive attributes, you know, I'd look to own those, and I would, you know, definitely be comfortable overweighting those. But there's also some large tech companies that, you know, the business model is questionable. Their technology is maybe at risk of essentially something better coming along or different and displacing them. So their future earnings might be at risk. You know, obviously we look to avoid those. To answer your question at a sector level, I'd probably think a small underweight. And that's more driven by, you know, I think there's other sectors that have more attractive valuations. And they share those positive attributes that we talked about: strong balance sheets, defensive businesses, and in that context, the healthcare sector is something that kind of comes to mind.
That's great insight. Mike, I want to come back to you with a question related to who wins with this higher short-term rate environment. So related to the Fed and the prospect of rates being cut, we talk a lot about how it'd be very stimulative to the economy. So a lot of companies, people, real estate win if rates are cut. But given the current environment where we have deposit rates so high, and maybe specifically to the overnight rate that the Fed is collecting when banks need to borrow, who are the winners? Maybe there's depositors of cash, but anyone else?
I think our CD holders are doing really well. I mean, you look at it for years, CD holders had really low or, you know, almost no compensation, and now they're winning. So the savers are winning, borrowers are losing after that being completely the opposite for a decade. So I think that's clearly helping a sector, and those people are spending. And so that part has been what's been propelling the economy higher.
Perfect. I like it. Adam, so maybe pull two things into one. We think of the phrase bubble will persistently exist in the world of equities since the late 90s and 2008, and people, it doesn't come up too often, but certainly we hear it. But pull that, which is more related to large cap and related to why small and mid cap have really lagged relative to large cap in the U.S. specifically this year.
Yeah, it's a good question. Is the U.S. stock market, given how well it's done this year, and it's actually up almost 50% since mid-October. So, you know, naturally people look at that and say, is this a bubble? You know, I would say no. Mid-October, the market was trading at less than 16 times earnings, what the market expects these companies are going to earn over the next 12 months. But that valuation multiple, what the market was willing to pay for these companies, went from less than 16 times to today it's 20 and a half times. That's above the long-term average. The 30-year average is about 17 times. You know, 1.25 standard deviations here. So is the market overvalued? You know, maybe slightly. But I don't believe it's a bubble. You know, often, because tech is leading, I think the tech bubble in 2000 is a natural comparison. You know, in that environment, the market was trading, you know, at least 25% higher than it is today. But it's just fundamentally different this time, compared to the tech bubble. You have, we talked about positive revisions, really strong fundamentals. These tech companies are sitting on cash. They actually make money. It's real. They generate a lot of cash. So just if you think about price to sales, right? So in that tech bubble, you know, the amount of companies that were trading at huge multiples to sales, because many of them didn't have any earnings. compare it to what's going on today, you know, in 2000, it was at least twice as much, twice as many companies were trading at these high price of sales multiples. The other thing too, when you think about that tech bubble, the companies that had negative earnings did the best, if that makes any sense. So it was really driven by, it wasn't driven by fundamentals, right? This time is much different. These companies that are doing really well are just crushing earnings estimates and just printing money. So just fundamentally different. You know, another way to look at it is we talked about the S&P 500 trading at 20 and a half times forward earnings. The top 10 stocks of those 500 are trading at almost 30 times. If you look at the S&P, call it 490, it's much closer to average. So it's not the whole market is trading at elevated levels. It's a select part of the market. So again, just lots, there's still, I think, plenty of opportunities out there.
I like the summary there. It makes me think of when the typical metrics or multiples change from price to earnings to price to sales. Maybe that presents some red flags. I think that
price,
back to the
price to clicks, price to looks.
And back to the kind of mid-2000s of default risk-free mortgages, if you just package them properly and the different metrics of what a inevitable appreciation of what a property would have been. I'll keep that as a little red flag for me. As I come to you, Mike, with a U.S. housing-related question, the dynamics seem a little different than a year ago, but can you comment to your thoughts on both how how rates might affect the housing dynamics and where we are right now?
Sure. I think when you look at housing, the market has fundamentally changed with higher interest rates. So I was reading the other night some statistics put out by Fannie Mae. And they're, according to their numbers, 60% of homeowners have a mortgage. I would have thought it would have been a little higher. 70% of mortgaged homeowners have a rate below 4%. Okay, that sort of made sense to me. And 30% of mortgaged homeowners have delayed moving. So as I thought about this, it's sort of, there are two implications that sort of jump out at me. First, higher interest rates have an increased cost for most homeowners. If you take the people that don't have a mortgage and those that have a mortgage, that's where the rate is below 4%, that amounts to 82% of households. So with the higher rates, it has had less impact than we might think. The second thing is those with low rate mortgages are sticking, they're not moving from their existing home. They've delayed a move, and that's limited the supply of homes available for sale. So what we're seeing when you look at the current statistics in the market is weak existing home sales. We had a recent uptick, but generally those numbers have been weak. And that's consistent with this Fannie Mae data. And secondly, a strong level of new home sales to fill in that gap in supply. The other thing that sort of fundamentally jumps out at you in the housing market is this lack of supply has kept housing prices high. When you look back on a national level, over the past 4 years, housing prices are up 50% over a four-year period. So we've seen this incredible increase, which has, that's really created this challenge in the market for housing affordability. And again, Fannie Mae had some statistics. They went back 4 years ago, and the average monthly rent was $1,298 per month. So let's say $1,300. And you look at that, the average mortgage payment at that time was $1,050. So the economics favored somebody who was renting, going out and buying a house. It cut their costs, and they got tax breaks. So it really favored home ownership. You look at those numbers today, the current average monthly rate is now $1,500 a month, up from $1,300 4 years ago. But the average mortgage payment has now increased to $2,242. So you've got a mortgage payment now that's $2,242 a month versus a rent payment of $1,500 a month. So now the economics favor not buying a house. So I think that that's a fundamental shift in what's going on. Now, that may change over time as in, when interest rates eventually come back down, but it's still the reality today is much different in the housing market for somebody looking to buy than what it's been.
I love that perspective, Mike. That is a crazy increase of more than doubling the average mortgage payment over that period of time. And easy to see why you still see those multifamily or the rents increasing so quickly, because relative to mortgages, it's just more affordable. Well, gentlemen, as always, I learn a lot from you guys, and I appreciate you taking the time to join me today, and I'm sure our audience does too. Mike, I'll turn it over to you for some parting thoughts.
I've been thinking this week about corporate bonds a lot, because there's been a lot of supply in corporate bonds. When you look at it sort of this year, we've had the second, if you look at the first quarter, we issued $500 billion in corporate bonds came to market. That's going to be the second highest quarter ever in the history of investment grade corporate bonds. And while that's happened, yield spreads to treasuries have remained incredibly tight. We're probably right, probably today, we're looking at a 20-year tight level that we've seen over the last 20 years. So interesting. And I think corporate treasurers are opting to issue. There was probably some pent-up demand for the end of last year where rates were spiked up and they said, well, I'm not going to issue at these levels. But now companies are recognizing that on the investment grade scene, we could get at rates near 5%, and maybe over a long period of time, that's going to look okay. Maybe rates will go lower, but, you know, bird in the hand sort of thinking is saying, hey, this is a pretty decent time. I think that's a positive sign that corporate treasurers are issuing debt at these levels. And I think that's a positive sign going forward.
Well, I know I said parting thought, but now I can't help but a follow-on question there, Mike, related to how that new $500 billion of issuance is being used. A few years back, say COVID era or zero interest rate period, we were seeing stock buybacks like crazy. Not very much investment into really the business. What are you seeing, or what is your expectation for, is this, and maybe follow on, is this just recapping existing debt, or is this new debt issuance, and then what will happen with it?
It's a mix of both. It's some new and some redoing existing, and have some stuff rolling off. So that's happening. And I think you're going to see more buybacks. I think you're going to see as this goes forward. But I think there is more capital expenditures, companies spending money because they see that they have these opportunities.
I love it. Adam, parting thoughts from you.
Yeah, just quick note on small U.S. companies. I think it's really interesting. If you look back over the last five quarters, earnings for large companies has just been significantly better than small companies. In 2023, large companies, their earnings were around flat. But small companies, their earnings were down double digits. Think about what's expected to get reported here shortly for the first quarter. They're talking about large companies growing earnings by 8%. And small companies, their earnings are still going to be contracting. However, I think this is where it gets interesting. In the second quarter, expectations are that small companies and large companies are both going to grow their earnings by around 12%. And then in the second half and into 2025, the expectations are that small companies are going to have better earnings growth than large, which is what a more normal environment. And then if you also think about what's going on with interest rates, expectations that the Fed's going to cut three times potentially in the back half of the year, starting in June or July. And you think about small companies tend to have variable rate debt. And so they're going to benefit from rates coming down versus large companies have fixed rate debt and they won't see much of a benefit. That could be kind of a catalyst for some of that underperformance we've seen to reverse. So I find that interesting.
You guys have all positive stuff today. I love it. What a good way to leave the conversation. I appreciate it to our audience. Thank you for joining us. As always, reach out to any of us. We'd love to talk about these types of things. Adam and Mike, thank you, and we'll talk to you all again soon.